May it please the court, my name is Amanda Shelby. I represent the defendant appellant Jason Hinton. I'm here today because the district court refused to order the government to produce its confidential informant, the only percipient witness in this case, and thereby denied Mr. Hinton the right to prepare his defense in a fair trial.
Well, the threshold problem I have with your argument is that the court decided the issue with respect to the co-defendant. Your client sort of piggybacked onto that and adopted the boilerplate motion that was filed by the co-defendant. The district court denied the motion as essentially boilerplate, not being sufficiently developed as a factual matter with respect to the particulars in this case, but did so without prejudice, specifically inviting it to be renewed with further development, and your client didn't take the court up on that offer.
It's correct that Mr. Martin, Mr. Hinton's co-defendant, did file a motion that requesting that the government produce the confidential informant. Mr. Hinton did, as you said, piggybacked on that motion, and the district judge did deny it without prejudice and offered the parties the opportunity to refile. But I would submit that the district court erred when it said that that motion was just boilerplate. Mr. Martin's counsel did indicate in his motion why disclosure in this case was warranted, and that's because the confidential informant was the only percipient witness in this case. The government based the convictions in this case on recorded telephone calls allegedly between Mr. Hinton and the confidential informant, and telephone calls allegedly between Mr. Martin and the confidential informant.
So why didn't he develop that theory of disclosure of the informant's identity in a renewed motion, since it wasn't in the original motion?
I was not counsel for...
I understand that, but, you know, it's still his...
I would posit that the relevant argument here is that he was the only percipient witness. I mean, you could go into details about what he may have witnessed or what he might not have witnessed, but the central fact is he was the only witness to these telephone calls and to the drug transaction. Saying that he was the only witness other than the accused should be sufficient.
So we would have to, district court would have to disclose that in all instances? We have a lot of cases where a CI is involved in a transaction and it's a controlled purchase, so those would always have to be disclosed?
I would submit that if the confidential informant is a transactional witness and the confidential informant is the only witness other than the accused, then in those cases, the government should be required to produce the confidential informant so that the defendant can prepare his defense.
Even if the defense doesn't give the court any basis or anything, or any indication of how this witness is going to help, like we need him because he'll help us establish entrapment. We need him because, I mean, you're saying no showing whatsoever as to why it would be relevant.
I am saying that the showing
that was provided in camera, because you may not want to disclose to the government, for example, that to the informant what exactly the angle is, but there was no showing whatsoever. Just the fact that it's transactional, always disclosure, automatic, without saying how he relates to your theory of defense.
I want to answer your question in two parts, and the first part is to say, in this case, the relevant showing is that he was the only transactional witness other than the accused.
I get there were an. Go ahead.
Does this become a new rule
then
in addressing requests for CIs? Are we establishing a new rule in this case?
I would submit yes. I'm not aware that this has been a particular holding of any court in the Seventh Circuit, but it certainly is consistent with the holdings of the Supreme Court in Roviero and in Seventh Circuit cases like Tucker, where
Supreme Court hasn't gone that far to say transactional tipsters automatically are disclosed, should be disclosed.
I'm sorry.
I don't know what cases you're referring to in our circuit that even come close to that.
Well, at least in Tucker, for example, that's out of the Seventh Circuit. That's from 1977. That's a case in which this court said that, and I would submit that the holding I'm proposing is even narrower than Tucker. And that's because in Tucker, you had one witness who was testifying to one thing and another witness who was testifying to the exact opposite. And in that case, this court said that only the confidential informant could reconcile those two versions of events.
Right.
So it should have been only
that isn't the situation here. And even if we go back to the language of Raviaro, it says the if the defendant establishes disclosure is relevant and helpful. See, relevant means how is this going to help my defense or is essential to a fair determination of a cause. And so to me it's essential to the fair. You have to explain why it's essential, why his testimony would be essential. Like, what is he going to say? I understand you may not want to put the defendant on the stand. So what? But you've got to have some representation as to what he's going to say to just generally say we want him because he was the only one there. And we don't – I mean, it needs to relate to something. And I don't think you find it in Raviaro.
And respectfully, Judge, I would submit that without having interviewed the confidential informant, we don't know what he would have said. And so that's why I'm proposing that the fact that he was the only witness there should at least force the government to produce the confidential informant so we can at least talk to him and determine, is this someone who is going to provide evidence that would be helpful to our defense? So we can call him if necessary.
So you don't think your defendant could confidentially, in your discussions with your defendant, who was actually there, like you said, he can't relate to you what the confidential informant would say?
He could, but what if his testimony, what if he says, that wasn't me on the calls? We still don't know what the confidential informant would say.
Presented with those facts, the judge would have a much more compelling situation for disclosure, but those facts weren't presented. There are the facts, though, that the confidential informant is at the wedding and depicted in photos and has his J.D. nickname tattooed on his forearms, isn't it?
Yeah, Jay Cool, yes.
Jay Cool. Sorry. So that's pretty good information for the defense to figure out who this guy is.
I would submit that it's not. And
this must have been a pretty big wedding if they couldn't figure that out.
So at this wedding, it's co-defendant Winston Martin's wedding. Mr. Hinton is there, as is the confidential informant. Assuming that this was Mr. Hinton on the telephone calls, there's evidence that Mr. Hinton knew that the confidential informant's name was Chuck. But I would submit to the court that, as the government acknowledged at trial, in this culture, aliases are incredibly common. In fact, Mr. Martin got married under the name of Sherrod Claxton, and the confidential informant apparently didn't even know that his legal name was Winston Martin because it took the government more than two years.
The visible tattoos narrow it down a little bit.
Those tattoos, Your Honor, were on Jason Hinton's arms.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Not on the confidential.
You're in your rebuttal time.
Yes, thank you. And we would ask that the district court reverse the convictions or remand for sentencing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McFadden.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Christopher McFadden on behalf of the United States. As you hit on with your questions, there is no rule that says disclosure is always warranted in any particular case, even if it is a case where an informant is a transactional witness.
But maybe that ought to be the rule that would reduce our caseload a little bit, wouldn't it?
But the reason for this rule, Judge, and you see it in this case, and this Court has said this before, we're dealing in the real-world environment of street gangs that are dealing narcotics, and this is where people get hurt. And this is why this privilege exists, Judge. And when they come in at trial with nothing more than a boilerplate, three-page speaking motion that the district judge said didn't talk about any of the specific facts in the case, didn't cite any relevant law, if you're going to say that that is enough to overcome the privilege, then there really is no privilege at that point.
But isn't it difficult for a defendant to say what an informant's testimony will be without having the opportunity to interview that informant?
No, at least in this case, and here's why, Judge. All the discovery had been turned over. They admitted in their briefs that they knew who the informant was. They had the audio tapes. They had the videotapes. They had all the FBI 302s. Every exhibit that we were going to use at trial, they had at the time.
And did you turn over the wedding photographs, too?
Yeah, those were turned over, too, Judge.
Because these photos were taken by the informant, right?
Correct. And he's actually in one of the photographs along with, I think, both of the defendants. Different photographs, but there's a picture of him that was turned over.
And he's not the one with tattoos on his arms?
Correct. Mr. Hinton is the one who had the tattoos. Okay. It says J. Cool, and that was one of the reasons we were able to say in the phone calls, J. Cool is Mr. Hinton because he wears it on his arms. But what could have been done in this case, and the privilege is overcome in cases like this, what I submit trial counsel should have done was to say, look, we need to interview the CI because we believe if the CI were to give truthful testimony, he would say, that's not Jason Hinton on the phone calls. That's not Winston Martin at the site of the drug deal. You know what? There were some recorded phone calls, but there were a lot of unrecorded phone calls where, you know, there was this relentless pressure put on me that would support an entrapment defense. That's just simply a matter of proffering facts that you think might come out and facts that you have a good faith basis to proffer. But they didn't do that in this case, Judge. Even when they were given the opportunity to come back and say something more, they didn't. The district judge gave them a roadmap as to what they needed to do. They didn't do it. I think this motion was more of an afterthought than anything, and there was no abuse of discretion, much less plain error. Unless you have any questions for me, I'll submit on our briefs.
No, no questions?
Thank you.
All right. How much time?
1 minute.
1 minute. Good, thank you. Just 2 points on rebuttal. First, although there's evidence that Mr. Hinton and the confidential informant were acquaintances, there's no record evidence that Mr. Hinton knew the confidential informant's legal name or how to contact him. And two, Mr. Hinton would have been willing to interview the confidential informant at the U.S. Attorney's Office or at the courthouse so that the confidential informant would have been protected, although we submit that in this case with a career confidential informant with several convictions who was paid $56,000 plus relocation expenses, that privilege was very limited in this instance. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Were you appointed counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, we thank you for your service to your client. It was exemplary. We thank the government, of course. It always does a fine job. We'll take the case under advisement, and court will stand in recess to the next session.